Chapter 2. We can never go back again. That much is certain. The past is still too close to us. The things we have tried to forget and put behind us would stir again, and that sense of fear, of furtive unrest, struggling at length to blind, unreasoning panic, now mercifully stilled, thank God, might in some manner, unforeseen, become a living companion, as it had been before. He is wonderfully patient, and never complains, not even when he remembers, which happens, I think, rather more often than he would have me know. I can tell by the way he will look lost and puzzled suddenly, all expression dying away from his dear face, as though swept clean by an unseen hand, and in its place a mask will form, a sculptured thing, formal and cold, beautiful still, but lifeless. He will fall to smoking cigarette after cigarette, not bothering to extinguish them, and the glowing stubs will lie around on the ground like petals. He will talk quickly and eagerly about nothing at all, snatching at any subject as a panacea to pain. I believe there is a theory that men and women emerge finer and stronger after suffering, and that to advance in this or any world, we must endure ordeal by fire. This we have done in full measure, ironic though it seems. We have both known fear, and loneliness, and very great distress. I suppose sooner or later in the life of everyone comes a moment of trial. We all of us have our particular devil who rides us and torments us, and we must give battle in the end. We have conquered ours, or so we believe. The devil does not ride us any more. We have come through our crisis, not unscathed, of course. His premonition of disaster was correct from the beginning, and like a ranting actress in an indifferent play, I might say that we have paid for freedom. But I have had enough melodrama in this life, and would willingly give my 5 senses if they could ensure us our present peace and security. Happiness is not a possession to be prized. It is a quality of thought, a state of mind. Of course we have our moments of depression, but there are other moments too, when time, unmeasured by the clock, runs on into eternity, and catching his smile, I know we are together. We march in unison. No clash of thought or of opinion makes a barrier between us. We have no secrets now from one another. All things are shared. Granted that our little hotel is dull and the food indifferent, and that day after day dawns very much the same, yet we would not have it otherwise. We should meet too many of the people he knows in any of the big hotels. We both appreciate simplicity, and we are sometimes bored. Well, boredom is a pleasing antidote to fear. We live very much by routine, and I have developed a genius for reading aloud. The only time I have known him show impatience is when the postman lags, for it means we must wait another day before the arrival of our English mail. We have tried wireless, but the noise is such an irritant, and we prefer to store up our excitement. The result of a cricket match played many days ago means much to us. Oh, the test matches that have saved us from ennui, the boxing bouts, even the billiard scores, finals of schoolboy sports, dog racing, strange little competitions in the remoter counties, all these are grist to our hungry mill. Sometimes old copies of The Field come my way, and I am transported from this indifferent island to the realities of an English spring. I read of chalk streams, of the mayfly, of sorrel growing in green meadows, of rooks circling above the woods, as they used to do at Manderley. The smell of wet earth comes to me from those thumbed and tattered pages, the sour tang of moorland peat, the feel of soggy moss, spattered white in places by a heron's droppings. Once there was an article on wood pigeons, and as I read it aloud, it seemed to me that once again I was in the deep woods at Manderley, with pigeons fluttering above my head. I heard their soft, complacent call, so comfortable and cool on a hot summer's afternoon, and there would be no disturbing of their peace until Jasper came loping through the undergrowth to find me, his damp muzzle questing the ground. Like old ladies caught at their ablutions, the pigeons would flutter from their hiding place, shocked into silly agitation, and making a monstrous to-do with their wings, streak away from us above the treetops, and so out of sight and sound. When they were gone, a new silence would come upon the place, and I, uneasy for no known reason, would realize that the sun no longer wove a pattern on the rustling leaves, that the branches had grown darker, the shadows longer. And back at the house, there would be fresh raspberries for tea. I would rise from my bed of bracken, then, shaking the feathery dust of last year's leaves from my skirt and whistling to Jasper, set off towards the house, despising myself even as I walked for my hurrying feet, my one swift glance behind. How strange that an article on wood pigeons could so recall the past and make me falter as I read aloud. It was the grey look on his face that made me stop abruptly, and turned the pages until I found a paragraph on cricket, very practical and dull. Middlesex batting on a dry wicket at the Oval and piling up interminable dreary runs. How I blessed those solid, flanneled figures, for in a few minutes his face had settled back into repose. The colour had returned, and he was deriding the Surrey bowling in healthy irritation. We were saved a retreat into the past, and I had learnt my lesson. Read English news, yes, and English sport, politics and pomposity, but in future, keep the things that hurt to myself alone. They can be my secret indulgence. Colour and scent and sound. Rain and the lapping of water, even the mists of autumn and the smell of the flood tide. These are memories of Mandalay that will not be denied. Some people have a vice of reading Bradshaw's. They plan innumerable journeys across country for the fun of linking up impossible connections. My hobby is less tedious, if as strange. I am a mine of information on the English countryside. I know the name of every owner of every British moor. Yes, and their tenants, too. I know how many grouse are killed, how many partridge, how many head of deer. I know where trout are rising, and where the salmon leap. I attend all meets, I follow every run. Even the names of those who walk hound puppies are familiar to me. The state of the crops, the price of fat cattle, the mysterious ailments of swine. I relish them all. A poor pastime, perhaps, and not a very intellectual one, but I breathe the air of England as I read, and can face this glittering sky with greater courage. The scrubby vineyards and the crumbling stones become things of no account, for if I wish, I can give rein to my imagination and pick foxgloves and pale campions from a wet, streaking hedge. Poor whims of fancy, tender and unharsh, they are the enemy to bitterness and regret, and sweeten this exile we have brought upon ourselves. Because of them, I can enjoy my afternoon, and return smiling and refreshed to face the little ritual of our tea. The order never varies. Two slices of bread and butter each, and China tea. What a hide-bound couple we must seem, clinging to custom because we did so in England. Here, on this clean balcony, white and impersonal with centuries of sun, I think of 4:30 at Mandalay, and the table drawn before the library fire. The door flung open, punctual to the minute, and the performance never varying of the laying of the tea, the silver tray, the kettle, the snowy cloth, while Jasper, his spaniel ears adroop, feigns indifference to the arrival of the cakes. That feast was laid before us always, and yet we ate so little. Those dripping crumpets, I can see them now, tiny, crisp wedges of toast and piping hot, floury scones, sandwiches of unknown nature, mysteriously flavoured and quite delectable, and that very special gingerbread, angel cake that melted in the mouth and his rather stodgier companion, bursting with peel and raisins. There was enough food there to keep a starving family for a week. I never knew what happened to it all, and the waist used to worry me sometimes. But I never dared ask Mrs. Danvers what she did about it. She would have looked at me in scorn, smiling that freezing, superior smile of hers, and I can imagine her saying, "There were never any complaints when Mrs. De Winter was alive." Mrs. Danvers. I wonder what she is doing now. She and Favell. I think it was the expression on her face that gave me my first feeling of unrest. Instinctively, I thought, she is comparing me to Rebecca. And sharp as a sword, the shadow came between us. Well, it is over now, finished and done with. I ride no more tormented, and both of us are free. Even my faithful Jasper has gone to the happy hunting grounds, and Manderley is no more. It lies like an empty shell amidst the tangle of the deep woods, even as I saw it in my dream, a multitude of weeds, a colony of birds. Sometimes, perhaps, a tramp will wander there, seeking shelter from a sudden shower of rain, and if he is stout-hearted, he may walk there with impunity. But your timid fellow, your nervous poacher, the woods of Manderley are not for him. He might stumble upon the little cottage in the cove, and he would not be happy beneath its tumbled roof, the thin rain beating at two. There might linger there still a certain atmosphere of stress. That corner in the drive, too, where the trees encroach upon the gravel, is not a place in which to pause, not after the sun has set. When the leaves rustle, they sound very much like the stealthy movement of a woman in evening dress, and when they shiver suddenly and fall and scatter away along the ground, they might be the patter, patter of a woman's hurrying footstep, and the mark in the gravel, the imprint of a high-heeled satin shoe. It is when I remember these things that I return with relief to the prospect from our balcony. No shadows steal upon this hard glare. The stony vineyards shimmer in the sun, and the bougainvillea is white with dust. I may one day look upon it with affection. At the moment it inspires me, if not with love, at least with confidence. And confidence is a quality I prize, although it has come to me a little late in the day. I suppose it is his dependence upon me that has made me bold at last. At any rate, I have lost my diffidence, my timidity, my shyness with strangers. I am very different from that self who drove to Manderley for the first time, hopeful and eager, handicapped by a rather desperate gaucherie, and filled with an intense desire to please. It was my lack of poise, of course, that made such a bad impression on people like Mrs. Danvers. What must I have seemed like after Rebecca? I can see myself now, memory spanning the years like a bridge, with straight bobbed hair and youthful unpowdered face, dressed in an ill-fitting coat and skirt and a jumper of my own creation, trailing in the wake of Mrs. Van Hopper like a shy, uneasy colt. She would precede me into lunch, her short body ill-balanced upon tottering high heels, her fussy, frilly blouse a compliment to her large bosom and swinging hips, her new hat pierced with a monster quill aslant upon her head, exposing a wide expanse of forehead, bare as a schoolboy's knee. One hand carried a gigantic bag, the kind that holds passports, engagement diaries, and bridge scores, while the other hand toyed with that inevitable lorgnette, the enemy to other people's privacy. She would make for her usual table in the corner of the restaurant, close to the window, and, lifting her lorgnette to her small pig's eyes, survey the scene to right and left of her. Then she would let the lorgnette fall at length upon its black ribbon and utter a little exclamation of disgust. "Not a single well-known personality. I shall tell the management they must make a reduction on my bill. What do they think I come here for, to look at the page boys?" And she would summon the waiter to her side, her voice sharp and staccato, cutting the air like a saw. How different the little restaurant where we are today to that vast dining room, ornate and ostentatious, the Hotel Côte d'Azur at Monte Carlo. And how different my present companion. his steady, well-shaped hands peeling a mandarin in quiet, methodical fashion, looking up now and again from his task to smile at me. Compared to Mrs. Van Hopper, her fat, bejeweled fingers questing a plate heaped high with ravioli, her eyes darting suspiciously from her plate to mine, for fear I should have made the better choice. She need not have disturbed herself, for the waiter, with the uncanny swiftness of his kind, had long sensed my position as inferior and subservient to hers, and had placed before me a plate of ham and tongue that somebody had sent back to the cold buffet half an hour before as badly carved. Odd, that resentment of servants and their obvious impatience. I remember staying once with Mrs. Van Hopper in a country house, and the maid never answered my timid bell or brought up my shoes, and early morning tea, stone cold, was dumped outside my bedroom door. It was the same at the Côte d'Azur, though to a lesser degree, and sometimes the studied indifference turned to familiarity, smirking and offensive, which made buying stamps from the reception clerk an ordeal I would avoid. How young and inexperienced I must have seemed! And how I felt it, too. One was too sensitive, too raw. There were thorns and pinpricks in so many words that in reality fell lightly on the air. I remember well that plate of ham and tongue. It was dry, unappetizing, cut in a wedge from the outside, but I had not the courage to refuse it. We ate in silence, for Mrs. Van Hopper liked to concentrate on food, and I could tell by the way the sauce ran down her chin that her dish of ravioli pleased her. It was not a sight that engendered into me great appetite for my own cold choice, and looking away from her, I saw that the table next to ours, left vacant for 3 days, was to be occupied once more. The maître d'hôtel, with the particular bow reserved for his more special patrons, was ushering the new arrival to his place. Mrs. Van Hopper put down her fork and reached for her lorgnette. I blushed for her while she stared, and the newcomer, unconscious of her interest, cast a wandering eye over the menu. Then Mrs. Van Hopper folded her lorgnette with a snap and leant across the table to me, her small eyes bright with excitement, her voice a shade too loud. "It's Max de Winter," she said, "the man who owns Manderley. You've heard of it, of course. He looks ill, doesn't he? They say he can't get over his wife's death."